Welcome to The Crimson Threat. I'm John Behrens, pastor of Restoration Messianic Fellowship in the Boulder-Longmont area of northern Colorado. Our website is crimsonthread.com. This study was recorded during our normal Tuesday evening Bible study. Enjoy the study. We are in Acts, and I think we finished off chapter 20 last time. There's an account of Paul's trip. And what's going on here is that he is on his way to Jerusalem, trying to get there for Shavuot, or Pentecost. And we're going to see that that's going to make a difference as to what happens in just a minute. Now, I'm going to skip the ports of call that he makes as he goes back. Not that they're not important, I just don't have anything to say about them. So let's go down to 21:8. On the next day, we departed and came to Caesarea, and we entered the house of Philip, the evangelist, who was one of the seven, and stayed with him. I have no idea what one of the seven means. The comment was seven deacons, and that's probably who they are. Thank you. Appreciate that. 9. He had four unmarried daughters who prophesied. While he was staying for many days, a prophet named Agabus came down from Judea, and among us he took Paul's belt and bound his own feet and hands and said, "Thus says the Holy Spirit, this is how the Jews in Jerusalem will bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles." When we heard this, we and the other people there urged him not to go up to Jerusalem. Then Paul answered, "What are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart? For I am ready not only to be imprisoned, but even to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Yeshua." And since he would not be persuaded, we ceased and said, "Let the will of the Lord be done." After these days, he got ready and went up to Jerusalem. And some of the disciples from Caesarea went with him, bringing us to the house of Mnason of Cyprus, an early disciple with whom we should lodge. So Paul is now finally fetched up in Jerusalem. We know that it is about the time of Pentecost or Shavuot, simply because he was hurrying to get there by then. So we can assume that it's probably within a few days, one way or the other, of Shavuot, probably before. So verse 17. When we came to Jerusalem, the brothers received us gladly. On the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. So he's going into the home church, home synagogue of the way. After greeting them, he related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they glorified God and said to him, "You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed. They are all zealous for the law. And they have been told about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or walk according to the customs." Again, we are talking about Jews who are members of the way, which we would today call Messianic Jews. The word on the street is that Paul is out there basically teaching people that the law is dead and that you don't have to circumcise your children, none of that stuff. Now, part of this stems, as we've talked before, from confusion. We've talked in the past about how Paul had two young men that traveled with him, Timothy and Titus. And Timothy is a Jew by birth, and that his mother is Jewish. Titus is full-blooded, 100%, dyed-in-the-wool Gentile. No Jew in him that we know of. And later on, Paul will say that he has Timothy circumcised, and he does not have Titus circumcised. So again, we've talked about that in the past. One of the things that's happened as Paul is going through the missionary journey of his, and we've read about it as we go, is Paul always goes into the synagogue first and reasons with the local Jewish congregation. Sometimes he is received well. Other times he is basically chased out of town, chased out of the synagogue, chased out of wherever. Often charges are brought against him, both within the synagogue and before the Roman authorities. So the idea that Paul is a well-known troublemaker among the synagogues especially of the diaspora around the Mediterranean basin, and that word would have gotten back to Jerusalem. How do you suppose it got back? We are dealing with a Feast of Ascent. I want to make sure we understand what the origin of the rumors that are flying around Jerusalem about Paul are. Whether it's, as you say, individual members of the Way who have gone out to the Gentiles, a la the book of Galatians, and said, yeah, I know what this guy Paul told you, but really, this is what you need to do. And of course, that's the subject of the book of Galatians, is you've got to circumcise and all that kind of stuff. And we know from the Council of Jerusalem back in Acts chapter 15 that there is a party among followers of the Way, which is Messianic Jews, who believe that Gentiles, in order to come in to the kingdom of God, need to be circumcised. That was the controversy before the Council in Jerusalem, and James, as the president of the synagogue, issued a letter that says, no, Gentiles do not have to be circumcised. So you can see that you've got people out there within the Way that are hostile to Paul's position, and then you've got plain old garden variety, black-headed, curly-haired Jews who are just hostile to Paul, simply because he's teaching about Yeshua. So the idea then that these people, when they come back into Jerusalem, especially for a Feast of Ascent like Shavuot, would be buzzing about this guy Paul, who has also just wheeled into town, is perfectly understandable. Now, backing up to what Brian wanted to talk for a minute about, you have all of these Messianic Jews, which are Jews following the Way, who are described as being zealous for the Torah. And I have no doubt whatsoever that they are or were. I was listening to, he wasn't a rabbi. He was studying to be a rabbi and became a Christian and now has a radio program on KLT. Very soft-spoken, reasonable guy. However, I happened to catch him when he was basically talking about this subject. And his take on this particular subject is, as you read the book of Acts, what you discover is that God and the Holy Spirit are teaching the apostles grace, and they don't get it at first. And one of the examples he uses is Peter and the magic sheet, where Peter doesn't want to go in to visit Cornelius until God explains it to him, and he says, I can go in and visit Cornelius. So his point is, these guys who walked with Yeshua were, quote, coming out of Judaism, unquote, and a lifetime of habits were not something that were going to go away anytime quickly. I have heard other Sunday preachers basically say you can't take doctrine out of the book of Acts, and their argument is a variation on what I just said. The early church, all being Jewish, all having been brought up in the Torah, still continued in their habits, not understanding, quote, the freedom, unquote, that had been purchased for them by the Messiah. So that's why, if you were to go to a reasonably competent Sunday preacher who does not believe in the Torah, he would just say, yeah, of course they were zealous for the Torah. They'd had a revival. Jesus was fresh among them. They were going back to what they knew, which was the law of Moses. In other words, that's how we get close to God, how we worship God. They were going back to what they knew as part of this revival. And that eventually all fades out as those people die and the church goes off and becomes the church again, or becomes the church. And that all eventually dies out and it doesn't have any relevance to us. In other words, you can't take doctrine from this. That would be the argument. I don't agree with that argument, but that would be how, if you were arguing with a good Bible-believing evangelical Baptist, you know, somebody that really takes the Bible seriously, and you were arguing about the efficacy of the Torah today, and you came to this kind of a passage, he would say some variation of what I just said. Onward. Verse 22, maybe? This is James speaking. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come, do therefore what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take these men and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses, so that they may shave their heads. Thus all will know that there is nothing in what they have been told about you, but you yourself also live in observance of the law. We talked in a previous session, Paul is also coming out of a Nazarite vow. Remember, he's on a ship to Cenchrea or someplace like that, and it says that he shaves his head because he had taken a vow. So Paul had taken a Nazarite vow, and the period of his vow came to an end while he was on shipboard. So he shaved his head, in other words, cut his hair, and in my parlance, he's got his hair in a baggie, and he's heading back to Jerusalem for Pentecost with the idea that he is going to have his hair burned with the sacrifice, and he is now going to pick up four other guys who are also in the same circumstance, and they're all going to go in, make a sacrifice, get purified from their vow, and have their hair burned on the altar. Okay, so that's what James is talking about here. And as I don't know that James particularly knew ahead of time that Paul had a bag of hair. I don't know whether he actually had a bag of hair, but I'm being whimsical here. Numbers chapter 6 specifically says that you'll shave your head, and burn your hair with the sacrifice. I am assuming that's what Paul has in mind, but I don't know that. All right, so Numbers 6:13. And this is the law for the Nazarite. When the time of his separation has been completed, he shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and he shall bring a gift to the Lord, one male lamb, 1 year old without blemish for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb, 1 year old without blemish for a sin offering, one ram without blemish as a peace offering, and a basket of unleavened bread, loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers smeared with oil, and their grain offering and their drink offering. The priest shall bring them before the Lord and offer a sin offering and burnt offering, and shall offer the ram as a sacrifice, peace offering to the Lord with a basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer also its grain offering as drink offering, and the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire that is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. I am assuming that's the hair from the top of the head. The only other place that we do liturgical barbering is in the case of a leper who is cleansed. And when the leper is cleansed, he in fact shaves his whole body, head to toe. So, you know, you could, just remembering it on the fly, perhaps get them confused. But this just says his head, and I'm assuming then it is what we would normally think of the hair of your head. Okay. All right. Now, notice what James said down at the end of verse 24. Thus all will know that there is nothing in what they have been told about you, but that you yourself also live in observance of the law. So James is saying that Paul observes the Torah, and he has no question at all that Paul is a Torah keeper. Later on in the book of Acts, Paul makes a statement, an official statement before some kind of an official. He says, basically, I have never violated the Torah or the customs of my people. Acts 28. Okay, so he's in Rome. And after 3 days, he would call together the local leaders of the Jews. So he is talking to a synagogue. And when they had gathered, he said to them, brothers, though I had done nothing against our people or the custom of our fathers, yet I was delivered as a prisoner from Jerusalem to the hands of the Romans. When they had examined me, they wished to set me at liberty because there was no reason for the death penalty in my case. But because the Jews objected, I was compelled to appear to Caesar, though I had no charge to bring against my nation. For this reason, therefore, I have asked to see you, to speak with you, since it is because of the hope of Israel that I am wearing this chain. So it's Paul's testimony that he is faithful to the Torah. So I assume he was faithful to the Torah. I have no reason to believe he wasn't. I've had these discussions with devout Bible-believing Christians who really know their Bible, and you point these things out and they just say, yeah, but that was then, and this is now, and it doesn't apply anymore. And verse 25. But as for the Gentiles who have believed, we have sent a letter with our judgment that they should abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what has been strangled, and from sexual immorality. So James clearly understands that the teaching of Gentiles is different than the teaching of Jews. The slander that is being made against Paul is that he is convincing Jews not to circumcise their children and not to keep the Torah. That's the thing that he is allegedly doing that they're upset about. James is very clear. You yourself keep the law. You're not teaching anybody contrary to the law. Gentiles are a different story, and we have sent them a letter. And we read that back in Acts chapter 15. So he's simply recalling the meeting where Paul was. Verse 26. Then Paul took the men, and the next day he purified himself along with them, and they went into the temple, giving notice when the days of purification would be fulfilled and the offering presented for each one of them. So they took a mikvah, went into the temple and told the priest, okay, we are coming up on the end of a Nazarite vow, so we need to make an appointment to come in here and do the appropriate sacrifice. 27. When the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the people, the whole crowd, and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who is teaching everyone everywhere against the people and the law and this place. Moreover, he even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, with him in the city, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple." The idea that this is Shavuot is important here. So these Jews from Asia, which is where he had just finished his missionary journey, he had been thrown out of some of the best synagogues in Asia, and all these guys are now down in Jerusalem for Shavuot, and they look and they say, "Wait a minute, I thought we stoned that guy," because they did. And so they raise a fuss. Verse 30. Then all the city was stirred up, and the people ran together. They seized Paul and dragged him out of the temple, and at once the gates were shut. And as they were seeking to kill him, word came to the tribune of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. He at once took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when he saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the tribune came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. He inquired who he was and what he had done. So we got a riot. Somebody's been being beaten up. We'll arrest the victim here, throw him into chains, and find out what it is about this guy that everybody wants to beat him up. 34. Some in the crowd were shouting one thing, some another. And as he could not learn the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. And when he had come to the steps, he was actually carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the crowd. For the mob of the people followed, crying out, "Away with him!" And by the way, this "away with him" shows up two other places, in Luke 23:18 and in John 19:15, where the crowd shouts of Yeshua, "Away with him, crucify him." "Away with him" sort of seems like kind of a benign thing to say, you know, get him out of here. No, that's what they yelled when they were convincing Pilate that Yeshua ought to be crucified. They would shout, "Away with him." Verse 37. As Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian then who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" Paul replied, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you, permit me to speak to the people." If I've got my pronouns straight here, he said to the tribune, Paul said, "May I say something to you?" And he said, the tribune, I think, "Do you know Greek?" Question. And then the tribune also says, "Are you not the Egyptian then who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness. What the Tribune thinks is that this guy is a rebel. Paul then replies, I am a Jew, not an Egyptian. I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you to permit me to speak to the people. And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great hush, he addressed them in the Hebrew language, saying, chapter 22, is Paul speaking. Brothers and fathers, hear the defense that I now make before you. And when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew language, they became even more quiet. And he said, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus in Cilicia, but brought up in this city, educated at the feet of Gamaliel, according to the strict manner of the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, as all of you are this day. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering to prison both men and women, as the high priest and the whole council of elders can bear me witness. From them I received letters to the brothers, and I journeyed toward Damascus to take those also who were there and bring them in bonds to Jerusalem to be punished. So again, giving his pedigree, which we've already heard earlier in the book, verse 6. I was on my way and drew near to Damascus. About noon, a great light from heaven suddenly shone around me, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And I answered, Who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Yeshua of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. Now those who were with me saw the light, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And I said, What shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, Rise and go to Damascus, and there you will be told what is appointed for you to do. And since I could not see because of the brightness of that light, I was led by the hand by those who went with me and came into Damascus. And one Ananias, a devout man according to the law, notice that he keeps emphasizing that this is all according to Torah. And one Ananias, a devout man according to the law, well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there, came to me and standing by me said to me, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that very hour I received my sight and saw him, and he said, The God of your fathers appointed you to know his will, to see the righteous one, and to hear the voice of his mouth. For you will be a witness for him to everyone of what you have seen and heard. And now, why do you wait? Rise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on his name. Ananias prophesies that Paul is going to see Yeshua, the righteous one. And of course, we know that he goes into Arabia for some period of time, and he does, in fact, see Yeshua. 17. When I had returned to Jerusalem, was praying in the temple, I fell into a trance and saw him saying to me, and this is Yeshua now, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me. And I said, Lord, they themselves know that in one synagogue after another, I imprisoned and beat those who believed in you. And when the blood of Stephen, your witness, was being shed, I myself was standing by and approving and watching over the garments of those who killed them. And he said to me, Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles. Up to this word they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and said, Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live. So what has just upset them after they have listened quietly to this entire soliloquy? So the idea that he's going out and evangelizing among the Gentiles is, I think, the thing that sets him off. The return of the 10 tribes is prophesied. So if he's out there gathering members of the 10 tribes, I don't know that they would have a problem with that. Because the rabbis to this day expect the 10 tribes to come back. So if he had couched his mission in terms of, I am going to talk to Ephraim, I don't think there would have been a problem. Could be wrong, but I think that's what's going on. 22. Up to this word, they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and said, Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live. And as they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust in the air, the tribune ordered him to be brought into the barracks, saying that he should be examined by flogging to find out why they were shouting against him like this. But when they had stretched him out for the whips, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, "Is it lawful for you to flog a man who is a Roman citizen and uncondemned?" When the centurion heard this, he went to the tribune and said to him, "What are you about to do? For this man is a Roman citizen." So the tribune came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" And he said, "Yes." The tribune answered, "I bought this citizenship for a large sum." Paul said, "But I am a citizen by birth." So those who were about to examine him withdrew from him immediately, and the tribune was also afraid, for he realized that Paul was a Roman citizen and that he had bound him. Now, the thing that always comes up in my mind is, how was Paul able to authenticate that he was a Roman citizen? I can imagine that your average cutthroat being faced with a centurion with a whip would say, "Time out, I'm a Roman citizen." It's certainly entirely possible that given his manner of speech and his manner of carriage, the Roman tribune would have said, "Oh, this is no common pickpocket that they've picked up here. This is a man that, as you say, is educated and so forth." And that may be all he's got. I don't otherwise know how he authenticates that he is a citizen. But given that the tribune himself had to purchase his citizenship, that leads one to believe that he has got some kind of a passport or citizenship papers or a green card or some kind of documentation that that tribune has purchased. And Paul himself may also have one. You know, he may have a driver's license from Tarsus with him that says, "This is Saul, and he's authorized to drive up to 4 horses in a chariot, and, oh, by the way, he's a Roman citizen." I just don't know. Also, something that should be obvious, but I'll say it anyway, the tribune and the centurions were afraid because Paul was a Roman citizen and they had bound him, which is to say they were treating him like he was a member of one of the conquered countries and were not according him the due process that goes with being a Roman citizen. 30. But on the next day, desiring to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, he unbound him and commanded the chief priests and all the council to meet. And he brought Paul down and set him before them. 23. And looking intently at the council, Paul said, "Brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day." And the high priest, Ananias, commanded those who stood by him to strike him in the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, yet contrary to the law, you order me to be struck?" All right, whitewashed wall. During the feasts of ascent, the tombs were whitewashed so that the pilgrims could recognize places where there were dead bodies and avoid coming in contact with a tomb, which it would have rendered them unfit to eat of a sacrifice, okay, or to sacrifice until they had been purified. So it's a 7-day purification process after coming in contact with a tomb or a dead body or bones or any of those kinds of things of a human. And so one of the things that they did for the Feast of Ascent is they wanted to make sure that nobody ran, you know, stumbled into a tomb by accident. So they whitewashed them. So the idea of calling this priest a whitewashed wall is sort of by way of saying, you're no better than a tomb. I think Yeshua says that at one point that, you know, you like whitewashed tombs, you look good on the outside, but inside you're full of bones and corruption. That's what Paul is saying here. Verse 4. Those who stood by said, "Would you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Now when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he proceeds to throw a cat into the pigeons. He cried out to the council, brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. A couple of things. First off, Paul studied under Gamaliel, who was a Pharisee. So Paul is a Pharisee by training, but even if he hadn't been a Pharisee by training, if he had been either a Sadducee or a Boethian or, you know, some other, an Essene or something like that, having been confronted with the resurrected Yeshua, I think he would have ceased to be a Sadducee. Simply because, no, I'm very serious. Simply being presented with the risen Messiah and talked to by the risen Messiah would cause one to call Sadducean beliefs into some question on the spot. As I say, he was a Pharisee to begin with, educated by a Pharisee, but even if he hadn't been, at this point he is. Verse 9, then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisee party stood up and contended sharply. We find nothing wrong with this man. What if a spirit or angel spoke to him? In other words, they are accepting at face value his testimony that Yeshua spoke to him on the road to Damascus. And from a Pharisaic point of view, cool. I mean, that's like going into a Pentecostal church and talking in tongues. I mean, of course those things happen. Verse 10, and when the discussion became violent, a tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn in pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him away from among them by force and bring him into the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you will testify also in Rome. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. So you got a bunch of guys that have made an oath, and they say, we're not going to eat or drink until we've gotten rid of this troublemaker. And one assumes that they died of starvation or thirst. Verse 14, they went to the chief priests and elders and said, we have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore, you along with the council give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more exactly. And we are ready to kill him before he comes near. In other words, you go to the tribune and say, we ought to talk to him some more. And on the way here, we'll intercept him and kill him. It will not be the case that he'll be killed here in the council. 16. Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said, take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him. So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, Paul, the prisoner, called me and asked me to bring this young man to you as he has something to say to you. The tribune took him by the hand and going aside asked him privately, what is it you have to tell me? Again, I'm not sure why he's taking him off into a corner unless he wants to be able to disregard it. In other words, you got somebody that's got a report for you, give me a report. But if it's concerning Paul, and you aren't really quite sure what you're going to do with Paul, it might be the better part of valor to hear what this kid has to say privately, rather than have him blurted out in front of the whole barracks, because once it's blurted out in front of the whole barracks, then it becomes public, and you've got to do something about it one way or the other. If, however, you take him off into a corner and say, all right, now what is this you want to talk to me about? If he says something you don't want to deal with, you can just sort of move him out the side door and be done with him. That's my guess. So, 19, the tribune took him by the hand and taking him aside, asked him privately, What is it that you have to tell me? He said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink until they have killed him. Now they are ready, waiting for your consent. So in light of what I just said, at this point, if the tribune wants to get rid of Paul and just be done with this mess, I never heard a word this kid said. Take him back to the council. In which case, Paul gets ambushed, Paul gets killed, his problem is done. He may have a few bruised up Roman soldiers, but what the heck. So by listening to him privately, the tribune's options at this point are still open. Whereas, as I say, if the kid had blurted that out in front of the entire barracks, then he's either got to send them down in the company of a sufficient guard to stand off 40 men, or not send him at all. But what he can't do is just, you know, attach the daily guard to him and say, you know, you two guys take him back down there, bring him back when they're done. He can't do that. 22. So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, tell no one that you have informed me of these things. Then he called two of the centurions and said, get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix the governor. So we'll stop there. He's going to write a letter to Felix and so forth, and we'll pick up here next time. Would somebody like to close in prayer?